and overseas. A dramatization of the book Six War Years, 1939 to 1945, by Barry Broadfoot. Adapted for radio by Jason Logan and produced with the kind permission of the Broadfoot Estate. In the early 1970s, Vancouver journalist Barry Broadfoot gathered ordinary Canadian men and women to relate their first-hand experiences in the global conflict against fascism known as the Second World War. Broadfoot invited scores of veterans and others who supported their country as civilian war workers and family members to give their subjective impression of a period when Canada became a major combatant and eventually a member of the United Nations, strongly motivated to preserve world peace. These eyewitness accounts expose the tragic cost of war and retell the personal stories, filled with laughter and tears, of those who fought the battles, raised the children, and built the framework for peace. We present it to you with the wish that we may someday achieve a lasting peace for all humanity.
The Right Honorable W.L. Mackenzie King, Prime Minister of Canada, speaking from Ottawa.
Despite her unceasing efforts to preserve the freedom of Europe, the United Kingdom has today, in the determination to honor her pledges and meet her treaty obligations, become involved in war. This morning, the King, speaking to his peoples at home and across the seas, appealed to all to make their own the cause of freedom which Britain again has taken up. Canada has already answered that call. The people of Canada will, I know, face the days of stress and strain which lie ahead with calm and resolute courage. There is no home in Canada, no family, and no individual whose fortunes and freedom are not bound up in the present struggle. I appeal to my fellow Canadians to unite in a national effort to save from destruction all that makes life itself worth living, and to preserve for future generations those liberties and institutions which others have bequeathed to us.
Yeah, I'm sure there were battles where men actually used the bayonet on each other, but sorry, I never heard of one. Can't even imagine it. No thanks. I know what a bayonet can do, though. We were taking training in Shiloh, and on this obstacle course, there was a fence. It wasn't too high, I'd say 5 feet, perhaps. And this chap missed, or slipped, or made a miscalculation, and instead of landing on his feet, he fell to his knees, and his bayonet went into his belly. For a minute, we didn't know what was wrong with him. But when we started looking, yeah, he punctured himself. It was just a tiny little hole about the size of a pencil and a bit blue around the edges. By the time the ambulance came and took him back to the camp hospital, he was dead. I can't even remember ever being so shocked, because this guy said he wasn't hurt and wanted to finish the course with us. The medical orderly at the hospital said the doctor told him the bayonet went only in about an inch and a half into that soft part of the belly. But he was dead in maybe 5 minutes. 10 at most.
This was in Normandy in the first Canadian field hospital set up. The casualties just came in batches. A lot of it was mortar and rifle wounds, and most would be brought in on stretchers. I was a Red Cross Corps worker, so my job wasn't actually in surgery or a real nurse's job in the field. But we had to do all we could to help. There were so many casualties that as soon as one spot was empty, or 10 or 20 spaces, there were others to fill them. That's why we tried to get them out by air or by ship from the coast within 2 days so they could be taken to England for special treatment. Some men were cheery, asking for a cigarette, joking. Some were in shock through loss of blood and just torn up bodies, and some would just want to touch you. touched the hand of a Canadian girl, and some of these were the ones who were dying. He got to know. They had this look about them, a whiteness, a look in their eyes. Some would die while you sat beside them. One did once, a young boy from Ontario, and he died as I was reading the last letter he got from his mother. He asked me to do it. He let out this kind of sigh, and his head fell down a bit, and then lifted up a bit, and then fell down again, and I knew he was gone. He had a lot of steel in his chest. I suppose he never had much of a chance. It was a time when you could work 12 hours a day and another 4 if you wanted to, and you'd crawl into the tent just dead. The bombing didn't bother us, the shelling. Sometimes it sounded like thunder rolling across the lake, just like at home at the cottage, hour after hour, and it got to be a part of you. If it was on, you didn't actually hear it, but when it stopped, you did. In air raids, it was us against them. We'd see Spitfires and American planes go dashing over. But mostly it was work. The usual things to keep them happy. We'd pass out tea with lots of sugar and newspapers like the Maple Leaf if we had any. Most or all of them spent less than 48 hours with us, so we never got to know them too well, and besides, not too many of them felt like talking. The first night you'd hear them talking to each other, sort of a low muttering, and I often wondered what they would be talking about. Then there were times when we'd help the nurses and the doctors. Say 25 men would come in at once. I nearly fainted the first time I cut off a uniform and saw a terrible wound. Just terrible. I hope he lived. Those doctors, those English nurses, everybody was just super marvelous. Through all that carnage, that's what it was. Carnage. What a waste. I remember seeing a flash, a shoulder patch on one jacket lying across the foot of the bed, and I knew that flash because it was the regiment which came from my hometown. I mean, about 4 or 5 small cities and towns had furnished men for it, and I had to look at that face. And he was unconscious, and it was Billy from back home, and I nearly dropped what I was carrying. I'd gone on skating parties with him, hay rides. I think I had a crush on him once. I don't think I ever knew what war and battle was until then.
While I was in a rest area in Italy, volunteers were requested for the 48th Highlanders, and I volunteered for that. I joined the 48th, and while moving out of the lines, I was concussed, and I got ruptured eardrums. So there I was in the 15th Canadian General Hospital. I'd also contracted malaria and yellow jaundice while I was being evacuated from the lines, and I was very sick for a long time, believe it. And one day, my brother Jim, who's with the Irish Regiment of Canada, comes to see me. He's my twin brother, you see, and we laughed and cried, and we were happy to see each other, and we made arrangements to get passes to go to Rome together. I got a 7-day pass, and Jim had a 14-day pass, and in Rome, we spent all our money and were AWOL for a few days, so we finally decided to go back to our units. We went, we had a shower, and I got talking about going back, and Jim said he figured that his luck has run out. He said that the last two men, the number twos with him on the Bren gun, had been killed, and he was pretty shook up when he talked about it. So I told him that I had a pretty good rest while I was in hospital and was being repatriated, so I would take his place in the lines, and he would take my place and go home. So we traded pay books and battle dress, and he went to Gralino to be shipped back to England, where I was supposed to go, you see, and I went up to the lines to his unit, which was the Irish. It took me 8 days to go the 500 miles where the unit was. I knew a few boys in the Irish, and I'd been with them before. When I got there, I had more trouble with my ears, and I had to go to the MO, and when I was there, he wanted to check my wounds that I had gotten in Normandy. I had to tell him that I didn't have any wound in my hand. The doctor was quite mad, and I got stripped for a complete medical, and that convinced them that I wasn't the guy that my papers said I was. And He gave me a blast and sent me to the commanding officer. The CO put me under arrest, and I was charged with being AWOL, desertion, and forgery. Now, in the meantime, my brother had been locked up as he had been sent to the dentist back at the hospital where he had to report as me, and the dentist fitted a partial plate they had made for me, and of course it wouldn't fit in his mouth. He didn't need a partial plate. So he had to tell them he wasn't the guy they thought he was, that he wasn't me. So he had the same charges as I did. They throwed the book at both of us. However, things did get straightened away, and they eventually dropped all the charges against us. My CO said that he'd read about such things like this, but he never dreamt it would happen to him. He said the incident would go down in the history of the Irish Regiment.
I was posted to Edmonton, Air Force. Now, this is the time of the start of the Alaska Highway, and Yanks, for Christ's sakes, Yanks everywhere. Mary, my wife, and young Tommy are first. They come out, and we live in a hotel and on an Air Force sergeant's pay. You try it sometime. But we're looking for a house, see? We try everything. Little limericks into classified ads, real clever stuff. Funny, but not a nibble. I make friends in the Queen's Beer Parlor with a guy in the circulation room at the Bulletin so I can get the paper first, and Mary and I rush out there, and there's three in line already. This is the way it is. 1 month goes by, 2 months, another. Hell, it looks like a divorce could be coming up. And we love each other, but three in a hotel room, about 10 by 12? Try it, my friend, just try it. So we're trying this tip again from my pal in the paper circulation, and we can't afford cabs, so we take the rock and roll trolley out there, and well, same old story, third in line. We're coming home about 5 o'clock, and I'm desperate. She's desperate. We're both desperate, and I say, Mary, old girl, when this car stops next, somebody's gonna get on and walk up to me and say, would we like a suite, big, nice and warm, good for kids, good for parties? I went on like that, just as a joke. And so, the next stop. Screech, clunk, clank, and somebody walks down the aisle. He's a guy I had worked with once, a nice guy. He's in the army, and he's got this big house in the west end of Edmonton, and the guy who's in the upstairs suite, he's suddenly posted that day to Helangon, and his wife is going back east, and there's this suite. Harry, he says, it's yours if you want it. I think my wife started to cry. I'm not sure, but I know I was damn close to tears, too.
Grab your coat, get your hat, leave your worries on the doorstep. Just direct your feet to the sunny side of the street.
It wouldn't be exactly right to say that everything was rosy for anybody. It wasn't for me. Not in Edmonton, and this was 1941. My husband was dead, and I worked in a plant making uniforms. The owner may have been making a fortune, but it was all going into the cash drawer. I had a girl 16 and a boy 13, and I knew if I could get to Vancouver, where my brother was in war work, I'd be okay. We had really nothing to sell, and after shipping suitcases to Vancouver, we didn't have enough for fares. So my daughter said, Mom, we could hitchhike. This was late September or October, and what a sight we must have made. We got to Banff in car rides, but half a day or so stuck there, I knew we'd have to hitchhike on a train. So we waited until a freight train came through, and there was this open door. I boosted my daughter and son up into the car with a couple of sacks we had, And then I had to figure out how to get up. And I couldn't. And then the train started to move. And I couldn't let the kids go. And they couldn't jump, so I grabbed onto the ladder at the end of the car. Did I say it was cold? It was bitter cold, with a bit of snow. And I'm hanging onto the ladder with bare hands, this steel ladder. And I can't climb up, and I know I have to drop off soon. And then this brakeman is coming along the top of the train, and he hears the kids bawling, and he runs down to the caboose and yanks a whistle, and the train stops. And he and another man come running up, and they take the kids and me into the caboose, where it's warm, and feed us. And that journey is a long, long way. And it's cold, and it's snowing most of the way, and we just wouldn't have survived. At Kamloops, the brakeman passed us on to the next brakeman taking over. We got to Vancouver because that brakeman passed us on to another brakeman. Those three or four railroad men saved our lives. And that's as sure as I'm here with you.
Can you remember? You're at your graduation, and there's the principal standing up there with the carnation in his buttonhole. And he's saying, the boys in the class of 42, Kelvin High School, Winnipeg, should rush out and sign up. But he's making all sorts of sounds like duty and responsibility and devotion to our cause and stuff like that. Everything except, take the king's shilling, boys, and telling the girls to pass among us handing out white feathers. Not all of us were old enough to tear right down to Smith and Portage and sign up for the army. But in 6 months' time, most of us would be. The army wasn't it anyway. Most fellows would have tried for the Navy first, the safe service, and then the Air Force. Even safer as long as you could stay on the ground, but awfully glamorous if you did make air crew. So mid-September comes along, and there I am. And in an hour, I'm in but good. If you were infantry, which I was, you went across town to the University of Manitoba, where they had a basic training camp. In my class, there were 18 guys, and they'd all got the pep talks. Serve your country. Your country needs you. And all that. But all through the weeks of training out there on the campus, I'd see these guys lounging around with girls on the grass, just enjoying themselves, spending their old man's money. Guys who had been my best friends, or so I thought. Hell, I guess they were. We're coming in from a 12-mile route march, soaking wet and breaking in new boots and cursing life back to our great-grandfather's time, and here would be a couple of guys I'd grown up with, dressed for tennis, walking across the campus to the courts. I found out later that of those 18, only 3 joined up. The rest went to college or university. Oh, you can see how this rankles. I'm not sure I'm mad because I'm missing out on the girls, the tennis, and living the good life, or if I'm cheesed off because I've been had, that I could have gone to university. I met this one guy out at the campus once. We stopped to talk, and I said, and I remember, when are you enlisting? To the point, get it? He said, never. If you don't have to, why do it? Something like that. Ever feel that somebody might call you yellow? I asked. Probably, but anybody who knows me knows I'm not. And he walked away. I had to admit that was true, that he wasn't yellow on the face of it. Then he called back, ever feel that somebody might call you a sucker?
Canadian manhood proudly marches side by side with the free nations of the world. Canadian manhood marches, and young Canadians talk the matter over.
Say, Joe, come here. Did you hear what Churchill said the other day?
No, I was out fishing that afternoon. I didn't get a chance to hear him.
Well, he was talking about Hitler. He was talking about the way the Nazis have got hold of most of Europe, see?
Doesn't sound much like news to me.
Wasn't meant to be news. He was just talking horse sense.
Well, okay. Don't be so mysterious about it. What was he saying?
Oh, one of those simple things that you don't think much about unless some guy draws your attention to it. The thing that seemed to stick in my mind was just one phrase. One by one.
One by one?
Yeah.
Well, what does he mean by that?
Well, that's Hitler's plan. Keep every nation out of the war until you're ready. And then take them one at a time, see?
There's nothing very original about that. Everybody knows that's Hitler's game. Why,
Yeah. Wait a minute. Listen to this. If all the countries that Hitler has conquered had known then what we know now and had acted accordingly, he'd never have captured them.
Sure, so what?
Well, so it's time we did a little fact-facing, isn't it? Maybe it's time we get into the war.
But we're in it.
You haven't got my drift, fella. I mean, it's time you and me got into the war.
Did you mean join the army or something?
Yeah.
Maybe it is. I hadn't thought about it.
No, I hadn't either. But I guess it's time we realize that sooner or later, it's men who are going to win this war. Men as well as machines. What do you think?
Yeah, I guess you're right. I guess we better swing into line.
There's a lot of people done it, fella. And I guess a lot more will have to do it before we're through with this business.
Okay. Let's go to work tomorrow and see what's needed. Let's join the parade.
There was this fellow from Kenora, and his name was Alan. I can't remember whether Alan was his first name or his last name, but it didn't matter. What mattered was he was the best damn soldier I've ever seen. And this was before he even got into the fighting. He was 25 or so and had worked for the railroad. And when we were going through Kenora on our way overseas, his wife was at the station. And how she found out, I don't know, but he got word to her somehow. It was only a 5-minute stop, I think, and she had their three little girls with her, and they all clung close to each other, the five of them. And the rest of us sort of hung back and just looked away. A lot of fellows weren't feeling too happy. It was what you'd call a sad little scene. A lot different than saying goodbye in your house on the last day and then going back to camp. This was it, going overseas. This was when you got down to the nuts and bolts of it. Now, the train gave a hoot, you know, some blasts, and our officers were yelling at us to climb aboard, and we did. And Alan did. And he's crying. And suddenly, a guy named Johnson climbs out. Now, this Johnson is a real bastard. Things I could tell you about him. Nothing meant anything to this guy, just a thoroughly bad egg. He runs up to Alan's wife, and he kneels down and kisses each of the little girls, you know? 4, 6, 8 years old. And then he kisses Mrs. Allen on the cheek and grabs the train as it starts moving out. And when he comes into the coach, he's crying too. Never forget it. He told us he'd spent his embarkation furlough with a hooker somewhere in Winnipeg, and I don't doubt for a minute he did. But I have a real strong, sneaking suspicion that somewhere he had a nice wife and little kids like Allen had. Funny about guys in the army. You can never tell about them.
Wenn der Führer says, wie ist der Master Ace? Wie heil, heil! Right in the Führer's face, not to love the Führer is a great disgrace, so wie heil! Right in the Führer's face. When Herr Goebbels says, we own the world in space, we heil, heil. Right in Herr Goebbels face. When Herr Göring says, they'll never bomb this place, we heil, heil. Right in Herr Göring's face. Are we not the Superman? Aryan Führer Superman.
Ja, wie ist der Superman?
Super duper Superman.
Is this Nazi land so good? Would you leave it if you could?
Ja, this Nazi land is good.
We bring the world to order. Heil Hitler's world to order.
Everyone of foreign race will love the Führer's face
when we bring to the world disorder. When the Führer says he is the master race, we heil, heil. Right in the Führer's face, not to love the Führer is a great disgrace, so we heil, heil. Right in the Führer's face.
When we got to England with the 1st Division, it was just about Christmas, and they put us in an old barracks in a place called Woking. That 1939 winter was one of the worst Britain had had in a long time, and the huts had no heating, and being Canadian, heating was one thing we were used to. We had to scrounge wood and coal, and we weren't very good at that because we were just recruits, so all in all, it was a pretty miserable winter. We were at the Inkerman Barracks. The lights were still on in London. They were still selling bananas and oranges in the store, and we were having a great time. The air raid shelters were there, but not used yet. There was no sense of impending doom, but a lot of comradeship. The feeling was the British would fight for a few months, put these people down, and go back to the usual, you know, running the world. And walking, we got our basic training. Sort of training. Well, we could pick up. They showed us the end of the rifle that the bullet came out of and gave us the red patches. You know, the famous red patches of the Canadian 1st Division. I was in the service corps by then. We didn't get much training in. But we were training with the 7th British Corps and the 51st Highland Division. The infantry was part of it. And so we just fumbled our way through the winter. I think it was late February. The 51st Highland Division went to France. And they were wiped out when the Germans started taking over. I want to say this. We didn't know what was happening. We knew the Germans were going like hell, but we didn't know anything more. Nobody did, I think. So they bundled us up, took us down to the coast, and put us on a ship, and we disembarked at Brest. We had all the food supplies, the petrol supplies, all the ammo, and it was our job to get it up to the front. So there we were, with the Germans maybe only 100 miles ahead, and the whole of France had collapsed, and we were still going on our merry jaunt. I'll say. It was like you're at a football game when it's over and everyone just surges for the exits and pushes and shoves and nobody cares about anyone else. French troops, civilians, old men, women, kids, bicycles, baby carriages, cars pulled by horses or cows, wagons, push carts, all going down the road. Tens of thousands of them. And they didn't know where they were going, except they'd say the Germans were coming. They called them the Boche. But we didn't have any orders. We just sat there. This was the time of Dunkirk. And then they say to get the hell back to Brest. Get back any way you can. That's when we scattered. Every truck for itself. So my partner and I headed back, and I think the Germans were maybe only a few miles behind, and these refugees, it was tough going past them. Thousands, and they didn't know where they were going. Where were they going? What was there to go? It was lucky there was no strafing by the Germans where we were. It was chaos. There was no order that I could see, no regimental discipline, nothing, just one vast screw-up, and it lasted like that for some time, as I remember. Anybody could have conquered England if they just could have got ashore. Britain had nothing left to defend itself with. All our prime fighting forces, and when they got back after Dunkirk, it was just a great mass of men. No material, no guns, no ammunition, no organization, no nothing at all.
Again, I'll explain. language only helps me tell you how grand you are. I've tried to explain by mere vist of shame. So kiss me and say you understand.
I didn't want to go to war. Why should I join up? Get myself killed off by some German guy who didn't want to be in the war either and didn't know me like I didn't know him or vice versa? You get what I mean? Except for one thing. I'm Jewish. And while my old man didn't want me to go, to join up, like, you know, why don't I go to the University of Toronto, be a doctor or a lawyer or something, but keep out of the whole business. But my mother, she's a battleship, that woman. She wouldn't hear of it. This is going to go when his time comes, and when he gets to Jerusalem, he's going to the Western Wall, and he's going to take out his psalm book, and he's going to read the 83rd Psalm. Mom sort of had the war all twisted up in her mind, you know. She'd read the headlines about the British 8th Army fighting near Cairo, and she'd look at a map, and holy smokes, that's only 2 inches from Jerusalem. 2 inches on the map, like maybe 250 miles. One son of hers is going to pray at the wall, you bet your life. So, while the old man is against it, there's Mom practically pushing me out the door on my 18th birthday down to the recruiting station. Join the army, my boy, she says, and you'll get there faster. Look, look where they were on the front page of the Star last night, not that far from Jerusalem. It doesn't fit her thinking that the whole idea of the 8th Army is to get far away from Cairo over to the west, as far away from Jerusalem as it can. She was one woman with tunnel vision. I join up. So, a year in Canada, 4 months in England, then France, Germany, and home again. About 2.5 years. Home, and my folks meet me at Union Station. Brothers, sisters, brother-in-law, you know, their kids, cousins. Real big Jewish reunion right in the center of the station. God, when I think of it. Mom gets to me first, and I get hugs and kisses, and everybody is around, and finally she says, Esther, did you use the book? I ask, what book? The Book of Psalms I gave you on your last leave. Then it hits me. The Western Wall, Jerusalem, the 122nd Psalm, the 83rd Psalm, standing up there with all those old men crying and weeping, the kind of Jew I just don't like. I tell her, Mom, I didn't get to Jerusalem. I didn't get anywhere near it. Our army wasn't going that way. We turned right instead of turning left. That was the wrong thing to say, making fun of something like that. She stops me cold with that look in her eyes. And she's a little woman, but solid steel. And she says one word. She says, Schlepper. Just Schlepper. That's what I am. A Schlepper. For Mom, I don't fight the war for democracy in Canada. I fight it to go to Jerusalem so she can tell the neighborhood women, Hadassah, Mrs. Moser down the street, and all the rest about her son, Isser. The crazy thing is, later when she'd calmed down, I told her I was sorry that my war career hadn't worked out the way she wanted it, and she came up with a beautiful line. She said, Isser, you just didn't try hard enough.
In the countries that have not suffered invasion, it's hard to realize what the coming of the Nazis would mean. In Winnipeg, they've just held an IF day. IF meaning invasion. The mayor is arrested. The flag of freedom is hauled down to be replaced by the crooked cross. The entire city is at once placed under martial law, and Nazi martial law at that. The freedom of the press, of course, is promptly abolished. Civilians everywhere are roughly handled, kicked out of restaurants, for instance, as all food is commandeered by the invaders. Religious freedom abolished. All places of worship immediately closed. Priests and ministers seized and probably murdered. The new order has no place for religion except when Hitler calls upon the deity for help. Schools would be taken over, for the children of the conquered people are taught quite a different culture. Everything would be Nazified as Hitler has tried to Nazify Europe. All property looted and paid for, perhaps, with worthless paper promises. The lead leaders and many others beside marched to a concentration camp to be starved, ill-treated, and tortured. All this and much more would happen here if...
It was like kids playing cowboys and Indians this if day. They had it in Winnipeg in 42. I remember there was snow on the ground. The idea of the if part was, what if German troops occupied Winnipeg? Then what kind of life would we lead? About 3,000 troops took part, and about half, I think, were dressed up like Nazis, and the rest were in Canadian uniform. I think the German duds came from Hollywood, from one of those war movies. That was one part of the if. The other part was that this here invasion of Winnipeg would go on until a victory bond drive was subscribed. All paid up. V-bond days were big then. Everybody was supposed to buy, and if he didn't, then he was a traitor. I spent any money that would have gone on bonds for booze. I had one kid in Mulvey School, and that's just off Portage Avenue. You know, the main drag? And these guys dressed like monkeys came into his classroom and tore all the patriotic slogans off the walls, yelling and shaking their fists, carrying on like monkeys. Oh sure, the Canadian troops lost. The Germans were supposed to have a division in armored vehicles, and they zoomed up and down Portage Avenue for a while and burned some old books from the public library and captured the Manitoba cabinet and put them somewhere. Can you really imagine people in the middle 20th century giving a damn about such shenanigans? I remember there was a picture in the paper showing the German troops giving a hard time to the newspaper seller at Portage in Maine for selling newspapers, I guess. They tore up his papers. They did some looting, too, carrying some furniture out of a downtown hotel. I mean, what the hell? Why carry furniture out of a building into the snow? It was so dumb a plot that even a fool wouldn't believe the darn thing, and Winnipeg was laughing about it, laughing their heads off. How far was Germany? 6,000 miles, I guess. But maybe that didn't have anything to do with it. I can't remember if they got their war bond money, but I guess they did. They always seem to, even if they had to put the Prime Minister on the radio and get him to cry his eyes out for the people to give. That was if day, and it was a farce.
Hello?
Good morning, Mrs. Smith. I'm calling on behalf of the local salvage committee. The country needs any old aluminum ware that you may have around the house.
Well, I'm not quite sure that I've got any. But if it's needed for the war, of course I'll have a look. Is it really needed?
Yes, it's needed badly.
Here is a call to every Canadian housewife. During the month of September, the National Salvage Campaign Office is conducting a campaign for the collection of aluminum scrap. Will you... We mean you, lady, sitting there listening to this program. Will you help? Every ounce of aluminum not now in use is needed by your government for war purposes. Your scrap aluminum, leaky pots, a pan which is perhaps burnt, old shoe trees, broken cocktail shakers, broken parts of washing machines or vacuum cleaners. Your scrap aluminum can help to win the war.
It was like in every big city. There was one big building full of people turning out propaganda. I used to say to my husband, I wish we could read a happy story about the war, or one that had something other than knitting 10 pairs of socks for the Navy in one day, or a new way to make rhubarb edible, or a mom whose six sons weren't all in the RCAF. The newspapers, they were just propaganda sheets. My goodness, on the front pages, war, war, war. And inside, how to cook cheaper, how to do victory gardens, why we should have carpools, buy victory bonds, and tell your friends they were traitors if they didn't load up on them too. And how to teach children that all Germans were monsters, with poison dripping from their jaws. The family down the block were Germans, Schmidt, and as fine a family as you'd find. And our kids went to school with half a dozen Italian families and played on the same hockey teams and went to the same parties. You'd look at the front page, and there it was. War in the Pacific. Japs bombing women and children refugees, while all we bombed were military targets. We were the good ones. Now, I'm saying these things, and nobody's going to come around and take me off to the pokey. Not now, but then, maybe. That's why people said they were Austrians when they were German. But you'd never read that in the papers. Only what the government wanted you to know. What they wanted to tell you. It was a farce. When Dieppe came along, and I had a son in it, although we didn't get ashore as he was in one of the boats that were in reserve, why, it must have been 2 weeks before we found out what was happening. That was a kind of propaganda, too. No news at all. The kind which was the worst was the casualty lists. And if they could have kept them out, I guess they would have. But they couldn't. I remember Dickie Johnson was missing in action. Bomber crew, you know? And we wondered why we hadn't seen his mother, a widow lady, for days and weeks. And then it came out in the Herald, and I went over right away. Right next door, but one, mind you. And there she was, nearly dead with grief. No, half mad with grief. Mess all over the place, and her cat dead from something, and she didn't care. There were all these mysterious shortages, and we weren't to ask why. Just do as you were told. Just buy bonds and don't ask for a decent pair of shoes or zippers. My God, zippers. What a crisis there. No zippers. Back to elastic. It was all war. War and how brave our boys were. And I don't care if they were brave. Did we have to have it shoved down our throats year after year? I surely think they sat back in Ottawa and Toronto and thought we were just a bunch of idiots from Halifax to Vancouver Island, and we could be told anything and we'd believe it. Yes, that's it. We could be brainwashed. I have a few old papers. The one where my son was wounded. I mean the one with his name on the casualty list. When my sister's son was killed on that Navy ship, the peace stories, and the D-Day landings. I saved those kind of papers as souvenirs. And if you want to see just how bad that propaganda was, you should read them. We could read the posters, listen to the radio, and we read the newspapers. And a war isn't ring around the rosy. It is serious, and many people are killed.
I used to work summers for Canadian Press as a female copy boy, and after I graduated from the University of Manitoba, they sent me out to Calgary to the bureau there. They got me a train berth, and I spent all night reading the manual about how to operate the ticker tape machine, the news teletypewriter in the office. The morning the invasion came was my first day, and when the first flashes and bulletins about D-Day came through on the perforated tape, they couldn't send them from Winnipeg to Vancouver until the whole line was clear. Right across the country on the intercity wires, they had to have my signal that the line was clear before they could go ahead with the invasion story. All I had to do was punch out C-A-L and then a few spaces and then C-L-R. That meant Calgary clear. And so the whole line would be open from Winnipeg to Victoria and the war could go on. In other words, three letters, a space, and three letters, and I punched it out, and my career as a bureau chief in a one-woman bureau had begun. But I was so excited or something that I must have punched something wrong, and the carriage return shot back, and the whole thing went wild with bells ringing and everything happening. I couldn't think. I was absolutely shattered. I knew it was the biggest story of the war, and there I was lousing up my end of it. I started to faint and hung out the window in this little room no bigger than a closet and tried to phone the phone company while I was hanging out the window and trying to get air. And on the wire service, everyone was signaling, "When are we going to get this war news in the West?" and stuff like that. Finally, Don Miller in the Edmonton Bureau figured out what was up and realized I was in a panic. Since he was connected on the same circuit with me, he just knocked out Calgary clear, and the war could begin again.
Thank you.
I remember. I was just a kid. We'd lost the farm to taxes long ago and just stayed on it because Dad could get a little work with the government, and he fiddled in an orchestra Saturday nights. I think he got $1.50 for that. In 1940, everything else seemed to be getting better in Canada, except on the farms in Saskatchewan. So Dad and Mom took us to Regina, and I went to school there. And then Selma, my sister, finished school and went to work in a meatpacking plant. She was up to her waist in animal guts half the time, she said. It was very hard work. You got paid by the month then, and Selma figured her paycheck would be about $65 or so, and Mom was looking forward to it. We were living in a little house darn near out on the prairie, and it was no fun. But Mom figured she could brighten things up a bit with Selma's first pay. Yellow curtains and things. Selma's late coming home that Saturday, and when she comes, in she waltzes full of beans. And she has this box, and out of it comes a coat. A muskrat fur coat, which was pretty big stuff in those days. It was a nice coat. Mother said, very quietly, "What's that?" Selma said, "What's it look like? It's a muskrat coat and it fits me just right. And here's the hat and gloves to go with it." And she takes out two bags and shows us, brown gloves and a little hat with some stuff on top of it. Mother said, "Where's your paycheck?" Selma said, "Spent, all spent, on this and this and my wonderful coat." I'd say our family fell apart right at that moment. Mother picked up her wicker sewing basket and wanged Selma right across the face with it and cut loose. "I think you little bitch," was one of her kinder expressions. She's screaming and Selma's yelling and hugging the coat to her and Mom is trying to grab it and it's just one awful mess. What's worse than a family fight? It was easy to see Mom's side. 6 years out on the Saskatchewan prairie, drought years, dry as a bone by June. So we ate free pork and whitefish, which the government gave away by the ton, and potatoes and turnips until they're coming out our ears. And when we get things turned around and seeming to go right, her daughter spends her paycheck, puts it on her back. And at that, Mom couldn't even afford a sweater. She was the Goodwill store's best customer. Of course, I could see Selma's point, too. Girls that age are pretty damned unreasonable. But she must have waded through a lot of guts to earn that money. Figured every penny was hers. It ended up with Mom getting hold of the coat, Selma storming out of the house, and Mom taking the coat back to the tailor downtown on Monday. He told her she could have $40 for it. After all, he says, it's a secondhand garment. Selma quits her job, goes to stay with a girlfriend, and the next week, after raising a bit of hell around town, she joins the Army, the Women's Army Corps. And, my friend, that was the last we saw of her. Every year, Mom would get a Christmas card. About every third year, it would say there was a new kid, but that's all. She's out in Vancouver somewhere, married again, probably doing very well. And Mom is dead.
I think we started deliveries at 4 p.m., and most or many of our telegrams would be killed in action, wounded, or missing in action. As I remember, there were a lot of missing in action, because this was fairly early in the war, and most of the guys getting it were in bombers and fighters, you know, the RCAF and the RAF. We'd get our sheaf of telegrams, you see. They had to be delivered at night, because there would usually be somebody home. Maybe out of 30 telegrams, 5 might be casualties, sometimes as many as 8 or 10, but that was pretty high. Sometimes, if we weren't sure, we could sneak open the edge of the slicked-down envelope. And if we saw it was a casualty telegram, then we'd go next door and get a woman there to come with us. Not to bolster up our courage, this was old hat with us, but when a woman just finds out her husband has been shot down and killed, she shouldn't be left alone. I always remember those telegrams. They'd start out with something like this: "The Department of National Defense regret." Well, that's all we needed to know. Zoom. Next door and get a neighbor. I always wondered why it shouldn't be the word regrets instead of regret. Isn't regrets better grammar? I guess we were such a callous bunch of young buggers, we didn't really think we were smashing some woman's life to bits. We were interested only because a word didn't sound right. If neighbors saw a telegraph boy going up to a house, they'd usually know. Not all that many people had phones then, the Depression being what it was. But there were two mails a day and one on Saturday. And sometimes you'd be in a house, and before you'd left, there'd be a couple of neighbor women heading for the house. This would be in the slums, the poorer districts, where people looked after each other better, not the richer parts, the poorer ones. I always hung around a couple of minutes just to see if they were all right. I'd always ask if there was something I could do. A few times I made tea for women, or I'd run to the nearest phone and call the husband or the daughter or something. I think it must have been the telegraph company that told us not to leave them alone. Jesus Christ, when I think of it, what a rotten way to do things. Sending a young punk of a kid on a bike riding down a street so everybody can see him and everybody wondering, is he stopping here or where will he stop? But you got to remember, later on, there were thousands and thousands and thousands of those things delivered. My own mother got one when I got captured. She said it wasn't so bad. I said, what do you mean it wasn't so bad? Well, she said she didn't mean it that way, but by that time, and this was in August of 44, the sight of the telegraph boy was a pretty common sight, with his black bag and his sheaf of yellow telegrams. And after all, the Carpenter kids and the Melnick kid and the Hudson kid, all within a stone's throw, they'd all got it by then, and they were just around the block. Remember when Lorne Green, the guy who became Pa Cartwright on Bonanza? He was on the 9 o'clock news, and he was called the voice of doom. That big voice giving us the war news every night, and a lot of it was doom. Well, I guess us kids, 16 or 17-year-olds, kids on our rallies and CCMs, we were the riders of doom, although I never thought about it that way. But I'll bet you a lot of women and men who got those telegrams thought of it that way. I guess I was taking part in just about the toughest job of war work and didn't even know about it. Yes, yes, I guess so. Riders of doom.
Carry on, Canada. The inexorable march of the days brings this country near the close of the second year of war. A transformed Canada, many of her men and women clad in uniform, all her people growing more and more conscious of the dangers to this continent of Nazi victory in Europe, faces the unknown future with courage in her heart and increasing understanding in her mind. More and more definitely, the attention of the Canadian people is drawn to the true peril in which they stand. And more definitely, burns the flame of our determination to face those dangers and to bear a noble part in bringing them to naught. Serious of purpose, strong in resolution, Canada carries on.
All pull together through the stormy weather. Carry on, carry on, carry on. Keep on trying, keep the old flag flying. Carry on, carry on, carry on. The sun is shining above the cloudy sky. A silver lining will greet you by and by. So all pull together through the stormy weather. Carry on, carry on, carry on. Carry on.
So Buddy and I, we got drunk in Brussels, and somehow we wound up in a fancy brothel that the Germans had set up when they were running things. The girls had gone, but the madam was still there. An old hag, but real interesting. God, she could tell you all about the Germans. So we're drinking her wine, and she says she's still under house arrest unless she's escorted by troops. For some reason, this was the setup. Canadians were like kings after liberating Belgium. We could do no wrong. So we say to this old girl, we're going to take her to the fanciest nightclub in Brussels. God, is she happy, and off we go. She's got this huge car and a chauffeur. So we go to this nightclub, and it's full of officers. And here I am, a corporal, and my buddy is a sergeant. And we've got this old bag in a 1908 gown with her chauffeur, and he's lugging along a case of the best champagne in all Belgium. 10 years old, maybe, and everybody else is drinking raw wine. Whoo! So I dance with the old madam, and about the third time around this tiny floor, I see a colored girl at a table, and she's with two Arabs in those long white burnouses, you know? And I don't know them, but I recognize her. It's Josephine Baker, the famous American jazz singer. So when the music stops, I send a bottle of bubbly over to their table. And about 10 minutes later, I ask her to dance. Me, a bloody corporal, asking Josephine Baker to dance with me. So we dance. Oh, the two guys in Arab clothes? Hell, they were American Negroes, sergeants in some regiment. But there was so much racial discrimination in the American Army that this is the way they had to go. Negroes, no way. Arabs, sure, come on in. So I get back to my table, and there are two American field officers next to us, and high rank. Colonels, I think. And one starts to give me hell for dancing with a Negro. Josephine Baker. To me, she's a great artist. To them, she's shit. So I put up with this crap for a bit, and then I got up, knocked off his hat because the silly bastard was still wearing it inside this nightclub, and I pasted him one, and then another right in the chops. And when his pal got up, I knocked him on his ass too. And by the time the police got there, if they ever did, my pal and me and our madam and her chauffeur were hell and gone away in that big car of hers.
This was east of Cleve in about the fourth day of our major assault. A tank rumbles up, sent back by the squadron commander, and it stops at our headquarters, and there in the turret with a Canadian lieutenant is a German officer. This was a bit of a surprise. Our patrol capturing a German officer like this? He was a lieutenant with a regiment from Pomerania, but he wasn't saying anything. Just his name, rank, and serial number, but he was willing to talk to anyone about anything else. Actually, he appeared at first like a good stick in his own way. But then it became clear he was still pretty hopped up on Hitler and Nazism. He'd been a Hitler youth and so on, but really knew nothing about Hitler. A perfect result of Goebbels' propaganda tactics. This chap had also helped turn out others like him because he'd been, so he said, attached to the psychological warfare unit of his own regiment and probably wasn't a combat soldier at all. But he sure knew the lingo. We asked him, didn't he know Germany was finished? And he said yes. The Russians had beaten them in the east, but in 15 or 20 years, there would be a new Germany, ready to go. Didn't give us much credit for kicking the daylights out of their best divisions in Normandy. He said he loved Hitler because he had given Germany the glory it deserved, and efficiency and strength and greatness and so on and so on. And the more he talked, the more he sounded like a vest pocket Hitler. We were bored with it all, and our major, a very, very hard man, had this grim look to him, and finally he said, "Lieutenant, take two good men and walk this man to the edge of the trees and give him a running start. 5 yards, he'll be shot for attempting to escape." He wasn't bluffing. This guy never bluffed. So I took our prisoner by the arm, and as I led him out, he said to our CO, he said, "I expected more from an officer of the Canadian Army. We have always considered you fair and worthy opponents." Something like that. So there I was, stuck. The fellow didn't deserve shooting, and he shouldn't be executed. Not by the rules of war. So I turned back, and old Fishface was giving me the eye, and I said, "Sir, the Geneva Convention? A question, you see." And he put down his pipe very wearily, I thought, and he said, "Yes, you're quite right. Then we'd be playing their game, wouldn't we?" And he said, "Do whatever you do with people like this." So I handed him over to the provost sergeant and told him to deliver him to the rear. When he got in the jeep, the German said, "Thank you, Lieutenant." And I said, "You know, something like, forget it. We've all got to make a living. Something inane." Then he said, "Would you consider, sir, that I was lucky?" And I said, "If you live to be 105 years old, Lieutenant, you'll never be so lucky again." Then he stuck out his hand. What the hell could I do? I shook it.
From coast to coast, the Dominion celebrates the long-awaited day of victory in the West. In every town in the Dominion, the strain of over 5 years of war is relaxed momentarily.
as Canucks pay tribute to their sons who have played such a vital part in winning victory in the West.
I'll never forget VE Day. It was the most vivid thing. We were in stuffy old Victoria. We were just kids. We wore skirts and sweaters and bobby socks. Just kids. The whole place went crazy. You wouldn't believe it. We heard about it, and everybody in our school cut classes. Even the teachers cut classes. And it was just kissing and hugging and screaming, bands and parades and people just going up and down the streets, just absolutely mad. There was no such thing as time or not knowing somebody. You hugged everybody you met and sang at the top of your lungs. There were sailors and soldiers with bottles of rum and men from the shipyards with cases of beer, and just everybody was drinking everywhere, and fellows climbing lampposts and going through the downtown streets singing and laughing. Nobody was throwing things or breaking anything, and the police just stood by and let people have a good time. And they had the band playing Roll Out the Barrel and other war songs, and this must have gone on for hours, but nobody got tired, not that I know of. And people were singing and shouting as loud as when the first whistles blew until it got dark that night. My girlfriends and me, we were about 13 or 14, and I don't really think we knew there was a war on, except for the blackout curtains, and because we didn't have the kinds of clothes we wanted. And some of our older brothers had gone to the war. But we just went crazy as anybody that day and got kind of hysterical and whooped it up as if we'd just won the war by ourselves.
Roll out the barrel, we'll have a barrel of fun. Roll out the barrel, we've got the blues on the run. Sing boom tarero, ring out a song of good cheer.
Is in women's liberation. When I was just about her age, there was nothing like that. There'd been a lot of talk about emancipation, you know, years before, but that was women getting the vote, wasn't it? But no women's liberation. Looking back on it, we had a pretty poor time of it. That's what the war did, though. Got thousands, oh my goodness, tens of thousands of women and girls out of the home. In 1936, I came to Winnipeg from Dauphin, just out of high school. There were three things you could do. You could work as a waitress and have some fry cook pawing you. I know, I tried that for 2 weeks. You could work at Eaton's department store mail order for $11 to $12 a week and walk out of there half dead every night to a lonely room somewhere. I had friends who did that, and that was enough for me. Or you could go work for a family. Of course, that meant that you were cook bottle washer, ran errands, washed floors, and you were the babysitter, but you know, back home in Dauphin, that's what I was doing anyway. I got in through a friend of a friend with a nice family named Gilbert, in a nice house, and I had a room in the basement, a bathroom with shower, and I got Thursday afternoons and Sunday afternoons off after the noon dinner. The pay was only $14 a month, but all in all, that wasn't bad. I was probably better off than those poor girls at Eaton's or some insurance company office because my bed and food was paid for. And that went on until 1940. In 1940, there were war plants starting up. And I went to Toronto because there was an airman stationed at Trenton that I was gaga about. But that didn't work out. But it sure got me out of Winnipeg. And I've never been back except passing through. It was good to be there when I was there. But when my girlfriend and me landed in Toronto, well, you could say we were in a different world. Toronto was a big city. And Winnipeg was just a widening of the road on the prairies. In the radio plant we both worked at, there were hundreds of women. All the bosses were men, but we expected that. Today they'd be demanding women bosses, but not then. Hundreds of women from all over Canada. I've stood at the same workbench with women who had hired girls just like me as domestics. You know, at $5 a week. And now they were complaining they couldn't get maids of their own to work 14 hours a day, cooking and washing and doing their dirty work because they'd all gone into war plants at $25 or $30 a week for a nine-hour day. Oh, you'd have thought we were all traitors. I asked one why she was working in a plant, and she said that her husband was an officer in the Air Force overseas, and she just didn't have much to do. So she was working in the plant, next to domestics like me. Funny. I guess you'd call me a stepper. That's a person who steps out. You never hear it now. Means a girl who likes a good time, likes to go out dancing and partying a lot, and not with one fellow, but with lots of fellows. Well, I sure stepped out in Toronto. I learned what this old world is all about, and I had a good time during the war. And I made good money, and because I always had dates, I saved some money after what I had spent for clothing and lipstick and stockings when I could get them. And our pay kept getting better and better. The war killed all the servant business, being a maid. And I think it did a lot to finish off the idea that a woman's place is in the home. My God, there were tens of thousands of us living a life, the kind of life that we'd never known before. Money and good times and lots of men, and more than anything, I guess you could say, freedom. Yes, I'll admit some just couldn't handle the freedom, but they were just a few. Husbands and boyfriends came back from the war and found their wives and girlfriends just weren't prepared to start washing dishes again. Must have been quite a shock. But some women had ferried Air Force bombers to Britain, and others drove ambulances and worked in canteens serving the troops, or in war plants handling very expensive tools, working on equipment, planes, instrument panels and things. And the companies found they could do all this better than men. It's no lie.
Anyone ever tell you it was all blue sky and sunshine for a guy not in uniform in those years? Sometimes, it was pure hell. Fellows who had tried to enlist and been turned down, they got this little pin they could wear. And if people knew what it meant, well, then they were okay. It was a deferment, vital to the war effort. But a classification like that meant that I had no pin. And to a lot of people, it looked like I was running away from the whole thing. Well, like hell I was. I was a master mechanic and stationary engineer. And I worked in this little factory just outside Hamilton. And the family who owned it had wangled a job making parts for bearings for Liberty ships. If the government had given the contract to somebody bigger, they'd probably have been better off. But as it was, we were vital to the war effort. I was 29 and just ripe for a uniform, but there I was, keeping that damn plant going, running back and forth between the machine shop and the boiler room like an Olympic champion. 18 hours in a day and 10 on Sunday was nothing, keeping that plant going. Every time I tell the boss to shove it, he'd give me a raise and run off to the procurement board and get my deferment renewed. I couldn't have joined the army even if I'd wanted to. That didn't help me, though. See, back in 1943, I was 6'1" and a good 195 pounds, none of it fat. But because I could make an engine part on a lathe out of scrap iron I'd find in the back of the shop, I was essential. And I took shit for it. Ask my wife. We couldn't go to a dance. We'd be bumped on the floor by Army and Navy types. And the Air Force wasn't as bad. But you'd hear all sorts of cracks like, maybe he's got a wooden leg. Or is that silver plate in his head where they pour the sawdust in? And I guess his old man's got money. And on and on. Christ. There were 1,000 insults. I heard them all. When we finally stopped going to dances, the wife just couldn't take it anymore. She used to cry about it. We got it on the streets, remarks you heard as you walked by. And I remember once in a streetcar, I was sitting at the back and I felt something tapping the bottom of my foot. And there was a paratrooper kicking me. And when I looked at him, he gave me the up yours sign. Sure, I could have got up and wailed him one. But he had two buddies with him, and if you don't think that's what they're waiting for me to do, then you're wrong. You had to watch yourself. There were thousands of us, I guess. Maybe we should have formed our own organization.
They say there's a troop ship just leaving Bombay, bound for old Blighty Shore. Heavily laden with time-expired men, bound for the land they adore. There's many an airman just finishing his time, there's many a twerp signing on. You'll get no promotion this side of the ocean, so cheer up, my lads, bless 'em all. Bless 'em all, bless 'em all, the long and the short and the tall. Bless all the sergeants and WO1s, bless all the corporals and their blinking sons, 'cause we're saying goodbye to them all. As back to their billets they crawl, you'll get no promotion this side of the ocean, so cheer up, my lads, bless 'em all. They say if you work hard you'll get better pay, we've heard all that before. Clean up your buttons and polish your boots, scrub out the barrack room floor. There's many a rookie has taken it in, hoop, line and sinker and all. You'll get no promotion this side of the ocean, so cheer up, my lads, bless 'em all. Bless 'em all, bless 'em all, the long and the short and the tall. Bless all the sergeants and WO1s, bless all the corporals and their blinking sons, 'cause we're saying goodbye to them all. As back to their billets they crawl, you'll get no promotion this side of the ocean, so cheer up, my lads, bless 'em all. Now they say that the sergeant's a very nice chap. Oh, what a tale to tell. Ask him for leave on a Saturday night, he'll pay your fare home as well. There's many an airman has blighted his life through writing rude words on the wall. You'll get no promotion this side of the ocean, so cheer up, my lads, bless 'em all.
Bless 'em all,
bless 'em all,
bless 'em all,
bless 'em all, the long and the short and the tall. Bless all the sergeants and WO1s, bless all the corporals and their blinking sons, 'cause we're saying goodbye to them all. As back to their billets they crawl, you'll get no promotion this side of the ocean, so cheer up, my lads, bless 'em all. Nobody knows what a twerp you have been, so cheer up, my lads, bless 'em all.
Oh, the war brides. Oh, yes, I remember them. They'd be landed off the boats in Montreal, and the Red Cross Corps would take them to Toronto and then pass them on to Winnipeg and then to Calgary or Edmonton, where we'd meet them and bring them to Vancouver. Some were terrified. But they were a jolly bunch and laughing, and they'd been through a lot of adversity, rationing, bombing, years of war. But as they got closer to Vancouver, some would come up to me and say, "Do you think I'll know him?" And I'd say, "Sure, you'll know him." And she'd say, "But I only knew him for a week or for 6 weeks, and then he was sent home wounded, and that's the last I saw of him. Do you think he'll be in uniform so I'll know him?" I'd have to say, "No, he probably won't be in uniform, but he would know her." That used to cheer them up. And you know, when we arrived, there was always somebody to meet them, and they'd all find their husbands. But the night before, oh, the excitement. Some of them had babies, little children, and there was always one nurse with them, an RN, plus two of us Red Cross Corps for every three cars of girls, and they'd be asking us hundreds of questions, and the night before we got to Vancouver, the porters would bring in big tubs of hot water, and everybody would bathe. They'd do each other's hair, they'd laugh and joke and sing, but you could see that they were terrified, a lot of them. Some were very nervous. There wasn't too much sleeping done that night, I can tell you. And some were led on very badly, you know. Soldiers telling the girls their parents were wealthy, and when they'd tell me where they were going, showing me the addresses, my heart used to sink. The downtown skid road somewhere, and I used to think how terrible the shock was going to be. Some would be anxious before they even got off the train. The size of Canada terrified them. It was so big. The ride was so long. I'd tell them that once they left the prairies, it was like going into another land, a beautiful country, and the mountains and the rivers, the Thompson and the Fraser, those great rivers absolutely fascinated them. Some, of course, were disillusioned once they got with their husbands. There would be no big ranch, but just a shack in the hills somewhere, things like that. These lads had often led the girls on terribly, but they came through it, most of them. Some of them went home, of course. But I don't think I ever saw one girl on the train who wasn't prepared to be a good wife and to give her husband a good life. It's just that for some, things didn't work out at all. But by and large, I think everything worked out pretty well for most war brides.
It was something of a letdown. I think all of us felt it, and I've talked to English people about it, and they agreed that when it was all over, we found something important and vital was missing from our lives. I guess it was that the war was over, and we all had to go back to the ordinary business of living. The trouble is, or was, that so many of us had never had what I'd call the ordinary business of living. Myself, for instance, I came from a small village in Bruce County, and I took a year of university, and then I joined the Air Force. So all I knew was my father's dairy farm, high school, 1 year at McMaster, and then the Air Force. The only people I knew after 3 years away from home, Coastal Command, and then bombing Germany, all I knew were people from the Air Force and a few English people. I didn't know anybody in Canada, and I didn't know what I wanted, and I certainly didn't know how to earn a living. Once we were sitting around the mess and yakking, and there were a few English girls, officers in the women's division, awfully nice kids. There were some Aussies and a few New Zealanders and a couple of English and Scottish lads because we were kind of a polyglot squadron. And we were talking and one of the girls said, "One thing I do miss, the sound of our engines. You fellas coming home in time for tea?" We all laughed. An Australian chap said, "I'm sorry it's all over. I'll never have so much fun again. Now it's back to the salt mines for me. Bloody dull Melbourne." I'd like to say we were all shocked, but we weren't. We'd had it pretty good to very good, although a lot of our guys had died. Anyway, there were a few seconds while everybody thought about it, and guys were nodding their heads or saying, "Yeah," and, "Well, you're right, buddy." And then one of the girls lifted her glass and said, "A toast to the war." And the war was what we all drank to.
We give thanks to Almighty God for a great deliverance. And as your king, I thank with a full heart those who bore arms so valiantly on land and sea or in the air, and all civilians who, shouldering their many burdens, have carried them unflinchingly without complaint. Let us turn our thoughts on this day of just triumph and proud sorrow.
Boys are home again, all over the world, and rain or snow is all that may fall from the skies above. A kiss won't mean goodbye, but hello to love. Ships will sail again all over the world. Then we'll have time for things like wedding rings, and free hearts will sing when the lights go on again.
All in all, when you take everything into the overall plan, faint now of every consideration, I guess you could really, really say the enemy lost the last war because they had lousier leaders than we did. If you thought it was unbelievable pig-headed thinking on our side, there must have been even more on the other side. Stands to reason. I don't know who said it, but war is far, far too important to leave to the politicians and the generals. And I still believe that.
When the lights go on again, all over the world, and the ship will sail again all over the world. Then we'll have time for things like wedding rings, and free hearts will sing when the lights go on again.
You have been listening to At Home and Overseas, based on the book Six War Years by Barry Broadfoot, featuring the voices of William Lyon Mackenzie King, Dave Campbell, Bronwyn Smith, Tarek Leslie, Bob Fraser, Julia Henderson, Keenan Johnston, Lorne Green, Paul Herbert, John Prowse, Adam Abrams, Sean Harris Oliver, Lara Rose Tansey, Deborah Sears, Caitlin Docking, John Taylor, Adam Henderson, Nick Rinka, Maureen Rohde, Mary Black, Ashley O'Connell, Rebecca Walters, Garth Barrier, His Majesty King George VI, and Jason Logan. Produced with the cooperation of the Estate of Barry Broadfoot, the Union of BC Performers, the Student Radio Society of UBC, CITR-FM. This program was adapted for radio by Jason Logan, produced by Dave Campbell, and directed by Jason Logan and Dave Campbell. This is Seth Little speaking.
Listening to CITR 101.9.